Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 23rd of July. Coming up on the program, South Africa's mining job crisis. The Home Affairs Minister on clearing up the visa backlog. Stats SA defends the census undercount and diving into the substance of President Ramaphosa's opening of Parliament address. Was there anything that moved the needle? Let's start the program with an industry on the back foot. Anglo-American Platinum finalizing its retrenchment process with around 3,700 jobs affected. In its interim results for the first 6 months of this year, the group said that its restructuring process had been completed, with the most significant impact being in Limpopo. I'm joined now by mining commentator Peter Major, who's going to weigh in on the issue. Peter, welcome to you. And what's your assessment of the current state of the mining industry given these retrenchments? How much trouble is it in?
It's in real trouble, Jeremy, because when we talk about a stuck record, if you're washing dishes in the kitchen and you hear that stuck record, if somebody doesn't go over there, lift up the needle and put it in another spot, it will just keep going over and over and over. And we've stuck our mining industry in a deep, deep groove, a negative groove. And it's going to take literally a major effort, a concerted, determined effort to turn it around. It's in a groove that's taking it down. And if you just look at the numbers, any numbers you want of measuring this, you'll see how negative and how uninterrupted the downward trend has been. And let's compare ourselves with Australia. Let's compare ourselves with Canada. You know, why have they gone from 50 tons a year gold production to 250? You know, five times the increase in gold production in the last 40 years. We've gone from 650 tons to not even 100 tons. Now, why did we run out of gold? And China didn't run out of gold. They went from 25 tons to 400 tons. America, maybe 40 tons a year to 250. So why did all of these countries all of a sudden find gold, and all of a sudden we can't find gold? Did we mine all our gold out? No. Did we mine our copper out? No. We made a concerted effort to put together a horrible policy in 2004 that has really put so many nails in the coffin, nobody's going to escape.
So, Peter, is it just a policy issue, or is it also a lack of investment over a period of time?
Well, policy drives investment, Jeremy. If you can advertise an investment that assures people that they're going to get a rate of return higher than putting their money in a government bond, you'll have a flood of money. But we've done the opposite. We've almost guaranteed people you will never beat the return you will get in South Africa by investing in any industry, especially mining, compared to a government bond. So we're offering very high rates on our government bonds, and that's where the money's going that's used to go into mining. But, you know, we had a policy structured for 100 years here to attract investment because the people running the country knew they could not grow the industry without foreign capital. So they had modified and adapted and improved the policy, tweaking it here and there for 100 years. And that's why our gold production doubled in 40 years when the gold price did nothing in 40 years. That's why the people employed went from 250 to 500,000 just in gold mining. It's policy that drives investment. which drives increased production and increased employment.
So, Peter, specifically then, where do you believe recalibration needs to take place, given that there is huge potential, particularly in PGMs, when it comes to the development of green technology?
Look, Jeremy, all of our minerals are being produced by other parties, by other countries. We were just so lucky to be endowed with 70% of the world's known PGMs, 50% of the world's known gold, 50% of the world's known high-grade vanadium, etc. You know, you can write a long list of how we have been so much more endowed than any other country on the planet. So it shows we had to have a particular negative policy and legislation and attitude. It had to be really negative and bad to drive investment from here. So if that's what drove investment away, then if we remove that or replace it with something designed to bring in investment instead of designed to fulfill people's dreams that put all this together, that probably had not probably, they had little experience governing. They had almost no experience in business and investment. So that's who designed our policy. People who didn't care, who couldn't work out the implications, and who had no experience putting together policy and legislation that would have attracted investment, created jobs.
And Peter Major, how much of this is outside of the mining industry's control? And I think, for instance, the logistical difficulties that Transnet continues to experience.
Look, almost everything that government has its hands on is outside industry's control. And we see and hear and read every day how government wants to control this. Government seeks to control this. And we have a very rigid mindset that government here wants to control everything. Instead of maybe oversee, instead of being an umpire or a judge, they actually want to control. They want to write the legislation, control where the money goes, control who gets it. It's really what it is. And we saw it. That's called central planning. That was the former Soviet Union. And in China, which also tried central planning for decades, look what happened when they finally changed their policy to encourage foreign investment, when they actually allowed people to make money and get rich. You know, you get the world's second greatest economy that came from almost nothing in three decades. If we were serious, we'd be following successful examples instead of trying to create our own, which is a real mismatch. The falling infrastructure hurts. Zama's illegal mining, that really hurts. Lack of electricity, that all hurts. Yeah, and that's also contributed to it. So we have a lot of things contributing negatively.
Always appreciate the blunt assessment. Mining commentator Peter Major, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The new Home Affairs Minister, Leon Schreiber, has laid out his priorities, saying his department is going to prioritise, among other things, dealing with the massive visa backlog, as well as stabilising the department's online system. He joins me now. And Minister, first of all, then, can you provide more details on what specific measures are being taken to address this visa mess?
So what we've done is to put together a team of people from different departments within Home Affairs that are working around the clock to clear this backlog. We've also partnered through Business Unity South Africa with Deloitte, who have given us additional resources in the form not only of training, but also of people to actually sit around the clock and deal with this backlog. So we started out with over 306,000 applications in this backlog, and I'm happy to report that we've cracked 100,000 now. We've cleared more than 30% of that, and it's really a key initial priority in the department to make sure that we get this backlog out of the way, give ourselves breathing space to then reform the way the system operates going forward.
So what's the expected timeline then, Minister, for the remaining 70%?
Well, the concession that I granted on the first day in the job is running until the end of the year. And the only way for us to avoid extending that concession for a fourth time would be to actually clear this backlog before then. So that is obviously the goal that we have in mind. But I'm pushing the team hard and making it clear to them that the sooner we're able to do this, the better it's going to be for our ability to avoid a repeat of the situation going forward. But I think it is a really important initial litmus test for whether we can move this department forward with the speed and urgency that is required.
You have another issue, and that is this Immigration Advisory Board. What immediate actions, Minister, are you expecting from this unit?
So that board is in the process of being established. There are a couple of legal processes that we need to go through to advertise and invite people to join it. But essentially what it will do is bring together people from Home Affairs, senior officials from some other key government departments, and then a whole range of experts in the field of immigration and the administration of these processes. And the goal with that board will be to provide a forum where we can firstly repair relationships. I think it's common knowledge that relationships with stakeholders has really broken down, and we need to repair that. The Department of Home Affairs is embroiled in far too many court cases, for example, that involve routine things where people go to court because they think that's the only way in which they can actually get the department to act. So the forum will be important to bring those voices together and make sure that we can reduce litigation and improve relationships. But then secondly, it's also a powerful instrument for us to make sure that we get proper expert input. The statement of intent of the Government of National Unity talks very clearly about the need for evidence-based policy. And this is how the advisory board can play a key function in making sure that we get proper inputs on some of the policy matters that we'll have to tackle. One of them, of course, being the future of the Zimbabwe exemption permit. There are no predetermined agendas in this regard. The court made it clear in its rulings that went all the way to the Concord that there must be proper consultation, proper inputs from experts to make sure that we deal with this particular matter and a range of others. The advisory board is an ideal forum for that.
Minister, are you finding within your new department that there is a willingness among people to move quickly, given that this has not been the case in the past? And do you have enough people with the right skills to implement the changes that you're trying to make?
Well, there are a couple of things to say in that regard. The first one is that Home Affairs is massively understaffed. So when you talk about people, we have to start by pointing out that we're supposed to have 18,000 officials. We've got just about 6,900 at the moment. So you can just imagine massive understaffing is a huge challenge in this department. Despite that, there are people who have made it clear that they want to come to the table. I think there are officials who have not previously necessarily had the space to actually be elevated and empowered to do their job properly. And I think we have great opportunities to achieve that by embracing technology, for example. So I think there are people who understand that if you're that massively understaffed, you're going to have to be innovative and especially embrace technology. But of course, then we also know that there are deep-seated issues of corruption in this department. There was a report by the former DG in the presidency around this, and there are investigations from the Special Investigating Unit that are ongoing to make sure that we root out corruption and make sure that there's a zero-tolerance approach to that. So I think it's a matter of finding good officials, elevating them. The people working on the backlog project certainly are people who are willing to go above and beyond. And I think it's important that we empower those kind of officials going forward. But certainly there are some key appointments that will have to be made. I've got some critical vacancies and I really need to fill those as well going forward to make sure that we strengthen the capacity in the department.
How deeply entrenched is the culture of corruption within Home Affairs?
Well, I think that's where the investigation by the former DG, Mr. Lubisi, was really an important moment, because it laid bare some of the issues that are manifesting itself really sort of even at frontline level when it comes to permitting processes and applications, etc. So I think that there most definitely is a problem, but that this is the kind of thing that you have to tackle as part of a bigger reform agenda. There are ways in which technology can help reduce corruption, for example. Then there are the obvious need for disciplinary processes and prosecutions that reduces corruption. Then there's the creation of a new culture working environment where people actually are rewarded for doing their job and going above and beyond. That also provides incentives to reduce corruption. So I think weaved into everything we need to do at this department is the theme of making sure that we deal with this. But it's a multifaceted approach, and it involves a number of different reforms. It's not only one thing, one silver bullet that's going to solve this problem.
How are you going to manage and reduce long queues?
Well, I'm looking at a couple of ideas on how to do this. I think the first thing that will make a huge difference is simply getting the online system to be online. And I've said repeatedly now that this the idea of the system being offline is something that must become anathema in Home Affairs. It's not a joke. It's not funny. It's not something we can accept. And so there are some ways in which we could do simple things like speeding up the internet connections. I mean, you'd be surprised that some of these major Home Affairs offices are currently connected to lines with 10 megabyte per second speeds. I mean, that is just not sufficient. So there's a whole range of technological steps that we need to take. But then I think the other thing we need to do is examine how to make better use of the online appointment system. My view is that one of the problems we have is that the queues are actually not integrated. So in other words, there are people who would make online appointments and show up in the time frame that they are required to be there. But then there are, of course, also walk-ins at many offices. And that creates a real problem then with actually honoring the online booking appointments. And I think what we need to do is find ways of integrating the queues so that you have one queue to manage. And then finally, I would say that there are some innovative ideas coming. There's one office in Epping in Cape Town that has put together what they call the one-stop shop model, where instead of having to go to a separate photo booth and a separate cashier, often creates the bottlenecks, you'll be able to go to a counter and get the full service there, everything, the photo, the payment, the processing, all in one spot. And these things sound like simple things, Jeremy, but I think if we do these things right, you actually will see an impact on reducing the queues.
Minister Leon Schreiber, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Statistics South Africa says concerns by demographic experts at the results of the Census 22 and that they cannot be relied on are, in his words, unfounded and misleading. The organization was reacting to a report by the Center for Actuarial Research and has described Consensus 2022 as setting what they term an undesirable record for the highest undercount on a national survey yet recorded by the United Nations Population Division. All right, right of reply now, and let's talk to the Statistician General, Risenga Maluleki. Statistician General, welcome and thank you very much indeed. So how do you respond and address the concerns that have been raised?
For starters, Jeremy, in every census, we have had an undercount, and most countries that conduct what we call the post-enumeration survey, which is a tool that we use to calculate the undercount, have reported. So in our case, 1996, we had an undercount below two digits. It was about 9%, if I remember very well, but definitely 2001, it was 11%. 2011, it was 14%. This is the first time we have a high undercount of 31%, the lowest having been in the Free State at 20%, and the highest having been in the Western Cape. And of course, yeah, we expected that. We didn't know how high it would be. Conducting a census in the middle of COVID, at the height of COVID, people may say, yes, COVID is gone, they don't remember. But we went into field 2nd February 2022. The COVID restrictions were lifted on the 4th of April. By then, we're coming out of field in most provinces. The only province that we remained until end of May was in the Western Cape. So COVID was one of them. We had unrest in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng. And of course, we didn't test in KwaZulu-Natal and the Western Cape because KwaZulu-Natal was in the swing or at the height of the unrest. And of course, Western Cape, we had highest infections then. Movement was closed. And then we had floods in the Northwest, Mpumalanga and KwaZulu-Natal. And we had to stop field work in the Northwest. In KwaZulu-Natal, we had to stop field work for 2 weeks. So none of these issues, the entire world didn't know would have COVID. We didn't know would have unrest. We didn't know would have floods in the middle of a census because in previous censuses, they were not there. Mm. But having said that, an undercount which was released by ourselves. So it's not like this undercount was released by somebody else or somebody else went to catch stats, as say. Stats SA released this undercount as part of our rigor to show that these are the people we have missed. So having said this, we went to 17.4 million dwelling units. There are those that we could not find at home. There are those that refused. 1.2 million households refused. They refused to answer questions. But still, when you come out with an undercount, you adjust. So it's not just saying we missed these people. You adjust. And we have adjusted the population to be an estimate of what it was at as of February 2022. So a high undercount, an undercount for starters, low or high, doesn't mean that you cannot estimate a population. So let me give a good example. When we conduct the quarterly labor force survey, we go to 30,000 dwelling units, which is equivalent to slightly above 30,000 households. We reach in the region of about 87 to 110,000 persons. And then from there, we are able to estimate at a national level, just with 30,000 households. Mm. So with the census, we went to 17.4 million, not thousand, 17.4 million dwelling units. We reached out to 42 million people. So it would, I don't think all status staff members should still be in office if reaching out to 42 million people, we could not estimate the population of the country.
Mr. Maluleke, in spite of the re-estimation that you have done, how do you respond to the assertion, though, that we still need an alternative set of estimates in order to facilitate better resource allocation and planning?
When we say we need an alternative source of estimates, what we are saying is that these estimates do not stand the test of time. Now, when you finish conducting a census, Jeremy, we hand over the numbers to local and international experts who look at, and I'm talking about when we finish fieldwork and post-enumeration survey, we bring in local and international experts who are as good as the colleagues that have raised these issues from the Center of Actuarial Research, Dr. Rob Darrington and Professor Tom Moultrie, who I respect a lot. So these experts are the same as them. They look at the numbers, they come back and say, Stetser say, you are solid, including people who have conducted censuses previously in their own countries. Then after that, we go to the Statistics Council, which is a body chaired by people of different walks of life, including people from the academia. At the time, it was chaired by Professor Everett, Dave Everett, who is at Wits. Now, it is chaired by Professor Nompumelelo Nzimande Mbele. She was the chair of the population subgroup that looked at the census herself. She's now chairperson of the South African Statistics Council. The South African Statistics Council is a body that is independent of StatsSA. So they could have come back and said, Statistician General, you can't release these numbers. But all international and local experts brought in by StatsSA and all international and local experts brought in by the Statistics Council and the Statistics Council themselves, who have a responsibility to safeguard official statistics, released a statement. So the Statistics Council released a statement and said the data is fit for purpose. When we say it's fit for purpose, it means it's fit to be used for planning, including resource allocation. So now when we say we need an alternative set of data, I can't understand what we mean, because we have data that is fit for purpose to be used for planning. Right. Having said that, the two professors themselves from the Center of Actuarial Research were asked by the Statistics Council, not by StatsSA, by the Statistics Council. The South African Statistics Council said, come and evaluate, help us evaluate the census results. They refused. And then the second issue is that when the results were released, they came to me, Statistician General, we have the following concerns about this. I go and meet with them, send them a document, which I said, this is how we worked on the census. And not because they are academics. if you ask the same Jeremy or any Gogo in any village would have asked, would have given them, because we value our users equally. All our users are equal. When we had done that, when they released their report, they disregarded the report that I gave them or any engagements that we ever had.
Right. Mr. Statistician General, I am going to have to leave it there, sir. We are out of time, but thank you very much indeed for putting your officer's point of view across. I do appreciate it today. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
President Ramaphosa's opening of Parliament speech successfully captured the spirit of a diverse and cohesive multi-party government ready to get down to work. But it failed to tell South Africans how the new dispensation is going to do things any differently and any better. That rather blunt assessment from Vinothan Naidu, Associate Professor of Public Policy and Administration at the University of Cape Town, who joins me on the program now. Professor, a warm welcome. So what is your big worry here?
So, Jeremy, I think what the speech did was probably typical of an opening of Parliament speech. So in comparison to, say, a SONA address. So, you know, it was a speech fit for unity. There's a great deal of symbolism that it happened on Mandela Day, lots of references to reconciliation, national dialogue. And in many ways, an opening of Parliament speech should do that because it typically comes after a very bruising general election. And I think what was obviously unique about this one was that the composition of government has changed so dramatically. And so I think in that sense, the president did strike the appropriate tone, the sort of reconciliatory tone, which is kind of consistent with this speech in comparison to the much more programmatic, dense SONA addresses. But I mean, my sense, my concern is that I don't think the public were looking for this kind of speech. I actually think the public were expecting what I would describe as a kind of delivery reset speech. So how is this government of national unity, given that we just had a sort of a political avalanche hit us after 30 years, how is this government of national unity going to tackle familiar sounding and ambitious policy proposals, which the president outlined undoubtedly? How is it going to do it differently and do it better? So my concern is that the president, I think, spoke to a lot of issues that we already are familiar with. And there were some innovative and creative measures that he introduced in relation to sort of familiar problems around inclusive growth, poverty reduction, and income inequality. You know, he spoke about lots of interventions that he wants to make in a variety of sectors. But if you look at that speech, I mean, I asked myself the question, had the ANC won a majority after the 29th of May, would the speech have been any different? I don't think it would have. I think the same things would have been mentioned in that speech. And so in that sense, I don't think the speech spoke to the moment. It spoke to its tonality. It was correct in terms of the reconciliation motif. But I think what South Africans were looking for is what I, again, this delivery reset, in the sense that people were asking themselves, look, the results of the vote were inconclusive. In our minds, no party is effective enough to govern and has the kind of delivery strategy to do it. So in other words, we're saying to you guys, get together and come up with a different plan, come up with a different sort of delivery modality.
And Professor, let me ask you this then. Would it be fair to say that maybe at that juncture, and even right now as we have this conversation, this government of national unity doesn't have those answers yet, the ones that you've raised? It still is getting its feet wet.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, because I do think that the ANC government that preceded the current GNU have been speaking and putting in place, in a fairly incremental way, speaking to and putting in place measures to kind of rethink how the state delivers. So how does the machinery of state deliver and give effect to all of the ambitious policy proposals it wants to achieve? Let me just give you a practical example here. If I had written the speech for the president, I would have said to him, you make capable and developmental state the centerpiece of your message. Don't stick it at the end. What he did was he stuck it at the end. He spoke about inclusive growth, number one. He spoke about poverty reduction and income inequality. And he spent a little bit of time at the end saying that we are going to create a capable state. He spoke about the professionalization of the public service. I think that's incorrect. I think that you cannot achieve these very sort of ambitious proposals around growth and inclusivity and poverty reduction if you do not have a functional state apparatus. And so what he should have done is to say, look, and that's where you get the kind of delivery reset. I think what he should have done is to make the capable state the centerpiece of this speech. And what he should have done is spoken to issues like the sustainability of government spending, the bloated wage bill, the fact that we have a highly imbalanced distribution of public personnel in our government. So we have too many public servants earning too much money at the highest levels and not enough where they really matter, frontline services, right? Secondly, he didn't speak about the need to rethink, trim down the organizational structure of the state. You know, cabinet ministers tend to laugh this off when they're confronted with it. When are you going to slim down and reduce the number of government departments? And he didn't do that. He says he wants to do that, but we knew that given that he had to accommodate opposition parties, he probably would be under pressure to keep cabinet around about the same size as it is now. But I think, you know, we really need to rethink the configuration of the state. How does cabinet work?
Professor Naidu, let me ask you this question. Do you think that this indecision or lack of clarity might then be a portent of things to come?
You know, I've said in another interview that I feel I'm a little bit conflicted by how the president has managed the reorganization of cabinet in this sense. I think that he genuinely has, in terms of the allocation of cabinet ministries, made a pragmatic effort to get buy-in from opposition parties. So in the way that he's allocated ministries, he's done so in a way that is honest, is not trying to undermine opposition parties, is genuinely trying to bring opposition parties in and to kind of create the cohesion which cabinet's going to need to sustain itself over 5 years. I think he's done that well. I'm not sure, though, that this is going to be a high-performing cabinet if these really pressing issues around state organization are not addressed fairly immediately. So I think he's traded off the need to have cohesion within his cabinet, his much more diverse cabinet, to sustain itself. I think he's traded that off for a high-performing cabinet. So in other words, I'm not expecting much in terms of performance from this cabinet. This is really a holding cabinet until we get to the next election. The only exception to that is if cabinet doesn't get to grips with the actual structure of the state. Because if we don't sort that out, it's very hard to see how we're going to achieve all of those ambitious proposals he laid out around inclusive growth and poverty reduction and all income inequality.
I am going to leave it there, and thank you very much indeed for that very honest and blunt assessment. Professor Vinothan Naidu, Associate Professor of Public Policy and Administration at UCT. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you, Professor. And just before I leave you, our online poll, and it relates to our lead story today. What is, in your opinion, the most critical factor for ensuring the future success of South Africa's mining industry? Is it enhancing infrastructure, reducing operational costs, or increasing investment in technology? If you have a view, you can participate either on X or on LinkedIn. That is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.